Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is video artist and visual artist Julia Oldham, and we're going to be talking about a selection of her projects. Julia, welcome to the show. This is a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
I had spent a great afternoon yesterday watching your videos, and they were so fascinating. And what I love about your work is, although there's a lot of similarities, you really branch out and do a lot of different things. Did you always start out as a video artist?
No, I went to a small college called St. Mary's in Southern Maryland, and it was a pretty traditional art program there. We didn't have a lot of new media technology. There was barely a photo class when I was there. So I really focused on drawing and painting when I was in college, and then I ended up majoring actually in Japanese art history through a sort of series of classes that led me to this interest. My senior year of college, I spent half of the year living in Tokyo, Japan, to do some research on performance art. And while I was there, I took my first ever video class. And this video class was, we were using VHS tapes and this gigantic machine that you would plug them in.
I remember this technology well.
Yeah, it was very fussy, and it was really not easy, but I had a really good time. It was so much fun, and it was the first time I had gotten to explore my work in a time-based way like that. And so after I took that class, I knew that I wanted to jump into video as an artist. I spent a couple years after college working on a drawing and painting portfolio, but then I applied to grad programs where I knew I would have resources for trying that out. I ended up at the University of Chicago, which had fantastic resources for editing, and I plunged right in, and I never looked back.
You come from a science background. Your family does. I love the way you describe them. You describe yourself as an artist and storyteller, that you are, who was raised by a physicist, a rock hound, and a pack of dogs in rural Maryland. This background of your parents really seems to inform or have set off your curiosity about science, because so many of your videos, they intersect with science, and you've worked with scientists in your video, but they're really about the intersection of humanity and science. Is it true that your parents were an inspiration?
Oh, for sure. Definitely. When I was really little, my dad, who is the physicist, would tell me bedtime stories that were about oftentimes concepts like infinity or like the nothing that came before the Big Bang or the complexities of one's internal organs.
This has to have affected you, Julia.
Sorry, what was that?
This has to have affected you. I can just imagine you as this little girl lying in bed and your father telling you, like, well, before the Big Bang.
It was so frightening, some of these stories. And the nothing before the Big Bang was the most frightening thing that I could even begin to wrap my head around. And he would talk about these ideas as kind of fairy tales. And so my love of science storytelling really comes from that experience of all of those crazy science bedtime stories from my dad when I was little.
I want to talk about some of your older videos first, because there's a group of them called Strange Readings. And two of them just, I was rapt by, R-A-P-T. I want to talk about frustrations. Now, these are older videos. Talk to me about frustrations, because that seems to be both a video and a performance piece by you.
Yes. Okay, so frustration, I worked in collaboration with two physicists. One of them is my husband, Eric Corwin, and the other was his very close collaborator. And the three of us were best friends for a long time. And as best friends go, we would get into all sorts of little skirmishes together. And especially when we were trying to work on videos together, which we had started doing, you know, we'd argue about about ideas about like getting the science right versus making something visually interesting. So this dynamic between us, we sort of ended up thinking was perfectly captured by the idea of frustration, which is a word that in physics describes a situation in which three particles can never all be aligned in the same way.
Is this the three-body problem?
Oh, you know, I'm actually not sure. I don't know.
But whatever it is, you perfectly diagram the frustrations of the three of you trying to deal with each other. And parts of it become hilariously, like, it just doesn't ever seem to gel. And in the meantime, you're diagramming these things as they're going on in this on this vast clear place of plastic, and the viewers are looking through it at you. It's an amazing piece. It really, and it's very engaging. You wanted to sort of go on forever. Well, that's sort of scary to have lived through, but I just wanted to go on for years.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, the funny thing about that video was that in the end, we all scrapped it. We didn't collaborate on it anymore in the end, and it was just my project in the end because we got in too many fights and couldn't agree on things.
You know, and having watched that video, I think I understand that.
Yeah.
Now,
so it was definitely a real exploration of friendship through this physics concept that I thought ended up being a really amazing metaphor for friends.
It was also sort of like Heisenberg, uncertainly, like as much as you wanted to really get at what was going on, it always was elusive.
Yes.
And you couldn't quite capture it, and you couldn't quite gel, and none of you were working in the correct way in the right time.
Right. And so also this idea of collaboration, which I do a lot of collaboration.
You do.
And it sometimes really works, and it sometimes really, really doesn't.
What do you do when it doesn't?
One of those examples. Well, so I tend to push through even when something's not working out that well and try to make it to the end and then promise myself I will never collaborate again. And then a month later, I am collaborating again. So
now I have to talk about you and Chernobyl in the Chernobyl exclusion zone. Now, I know a lot of artists, and not one of them has ever said, you know what I'd like to do? I'd like to go to that Chernobyl exclusion zone.
Right.
But you went there.
Yes, I went last spring. I was there in May for about a week, and I was staying in the exclusion zone the whole time there's like a little hotel where visiting researchers can stay, and it's a sort of we'll take care of you completely hotel. They make you breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And so I was there for about a week with a guide and translator named Ludmila Yurashko, and our project was I was making a film about the stray dogs that live there,
right.
Who are potentially the descendants of the original pets that were left behind when the folks living in the Chernobyl area were all evacuated and told, oh, you'll be back in 3 days. Leave everything behind. Everyone was forced to leave their animals, all their stuff. And then later on, most of the animals left behind were shot by the government because they were considered dangerous and contaminated. But not all of them were shot. And there's this community of stray dogs that have been there for
wow.
decades and that are cared for by the Chernobyl workers, of which there are still thousands because Chernobyl is still being cleaned up and will be, you know, forever.
Did you have any trepidations about being there, about radiation and long-term problems for yourself?
You know, I didn't. I did a lot of research and discovered that the background radiation in most of the Chernobyl exclusion zone is similar to flying in an airplane. So it's higher
right.
than normal, but it's not crazy high. The danger is with surface contamination. There's all of these dusty isotopes floating around and landing on stuff.
Oh,
and
man.
You're not supposed to touch anything. And then also there are hot spots, areas where you could walk into a spot and be in extremely high background radiation. And that's why you have to have a guide with you there who knows where all of the dangerous spots are.
Now, there was the film Fallout Dogs, the video from that. But it was also the view of the Red Forest. Is that from the Chernobyl zone too?
Yeah.
In one of the films, I think it's The View of the Red Forest, you're carrying what I assume is like a Geiger counter?
Yes.
I was watching that as it was going up and down and registering different levels of radiation. Both of the films are very haunting. It's like something you would see in a horror movie, and there have been several horror movies made about the Chernobyl zone.
Yeah, right.
But you were there, and seeing the remnants of people's homes and houses, and to see these dogs survive. What other kinds of life did you see there that besides the dogs?
There is so much wildlife. When I was first researching going to Chernobyl, I found all these websites that said things like, in the abandoned city of Pripyat, there are no bird sounds. You will see no animals. And that's completely not true. Since the disaster, the Chernobyl exclusion zone has turned into kind of a nature preserve.
Yeah, I would imagine that. It's like the DMZ between the Koreas is like that too.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Well, so there's, I saw lots of foxes. I saw lots of birds and beautiful insects. I saw wild horses.
Wow.
Interestingly, there's also wild boars. There's, I saw the bones of a great big elk. Wow. And there are wolves living in the forest as well. A very healthy population of wolves that moved into the area because there's no people to hunt them.
You must have been ecstatic about the wolves.
Oh, I was so excited. I wanted to see them so badly, but I would have had to go way out. That'll be another trip.
Talk to me about your emotions about being there, about what it was like to confront that disaster.
Well, you know, I think a lot about the way that people are so attracted to what is abandoned. Mm-hmm. You know, there's these hashtags on Instagram, like ruin porn, abandoned places, urbex. And there's something about those remnants that I think are just so alluring to people. And there's a combined feeling of, you know, intense curiosity and also real sadness. And I don't know, maybe it's just the complexity of feelings that comes along with seeing these sorts of places that is what makes them so compelling. While I was there, though, I got to meet someone who still lived there, a self-settler named Valentina. And so it was interesting to see both the remnants of ruined lives and also the way that certain people decided, I'm not evacuating, I'm staying here and enduring.
Wow.
Yeah, it was fascinating. But overall, I think, you know, I had this sense of just profound fascination.
It comes out in both of the videos. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is video artist, performance artist, and visual artist, Julia Oldham. And we've been talking about a number of her videos, which are on her website. So just look up Julia, Oldham, and you'll find her website and find these films there. One of the things that's a very important part of videos is a soundtrack, music soundtrack. And talk to me about work with a number of different artists on those.
Yes. I do make some music myself, which I really enjoy, but I'm very much a dabbler in music. And so on certain projects, I have collaborated with musicians. And so I made a video a few years ago called Laika's Lullaby.
Yes. And you have to explain who Laika was for people who don't remember.
Laika was the first living thing to go into orbit, and she was a stray dog in Moscow that got picked up by scientists during the Soviet times and trained to be able to sit extremely still for a long time in a tiny little capsule. And she was such a good dog, she was so good at learning that she got chosen to go into space. Unfortunately, it was a one-way trip because the scientists didn't have time to develop a capsule that could also bring her back. This was 1957. And so it's a really heartbreaking story. It was one that really, really got to me. I mean, she's such a, you know, she's this little pop culture hero, but she
She is. It's amazing. There's a new book out about her and all the weird paraphernalia that was made featuring her, a likeness of her, you know, salt and pepper shakers, plates, all sorts of stuff, celebrating her, but it's as if they are totally ignoring the tragic end of her life.
Right. Right. Well, and the reality of her death was kept a secret for something like 40 years.
Yeah.
She actually died very shortly after getting into orbit from overheating, but the Soviet government maintained for decades that she died peacefully after a week, and the story went back and forth between her being given a lethal injection or like peacefully running out of oxygen, which was absolutely not true. But so for this video, I was working with a musician named Lindsay Keith, mm-hmm. and she created the most beautiful song that ended up being the soundtrack of this story, and it is a lullaby. It feels like a lullaby, but it's also got this real darkness, real sadness, and in it she uses sounds that were recorded from the Sputnik capsules. And so she's using historical sounds that she finds and mixing them into this larger piece. And it just, I think that video ended up being very successful and really traveling around a lot. And I think in large part because the music was so beautiful and really pulled people into the story. So working with musicians makes a huge difference.
Do you you obviously finish the video first and then show it to the musician and then work with them to develop the soundtrack?
No, actually, not with Lindsay. Huh. We were working independently at the same time.
That's fascinating.
I was developing, so this is an animated piece. I was developing animation, and ultimately, I fit my animation to her music. She gave me the song, and I put the animations together and built the story using her song as a structural guide.
Wow. Now, you also have done a graphic novella, I guess would be the right term, a 14-page one, The Loneliest Place, which is also about space and a dog.
Yes, that piece, it was somewhat inspired by Laika, and it's about a robotic dog that it's sort of hinted that he used to be a real dog but got turned into a robot, and he's the scientific collaborator of an astrophysicist, and together they embark on this journey to discover whether you can escape a black hole, whether you can approach a black hole and start to go into it and escape it. And so I built this story. It's really a kind of a love story about their separation and about relativity, the way that he's the robot dog is really only gone into space for a very short amount of time, but his human collaborator ages and becomes an old lady in that very short amount of time due to relativity.
I love it. I love that work, and it's beautiful too. It's and I love the way that you do the dialogue and the descriptions as it goes across the page. It's really, really beautiful.
Oh, thanks. I'm happy to hear that.
Let's talk about a work in progress you're working on now, which I became very fascinated by because I've been fascinated about these spaces. Undiscovered City is a project. It's a work in progress. You've found some of the spaces that you've found in this project are these spaces that when you have highways that have exit ramps, there's often a big piece of wild area that's sort of cut off from everything surrounded by highway. And that's some of the kind of areas you've been exploring.
Yes. So I've been working with the New York City Urban Field Station, which is a collaboration between the New York City Parks Department and the U.S. Forest Service. And they are basically doing all sorts of research on urban wilderness. And through this collaboration, I've been meeting with lots of scientists, volunteers, naturalists, gardeners, beekeepers, and hearing their stories about their experiences in these urban spaces of urban wilderness. And the Urban Field Station is based way out in Queens, sort of on the edge of Queens. And there's some really wild and woolly stuff out there. It's amazing. And yes, as you were mentioning, one of the places that I got really interested in is Willett Bay, and you can only access this little bay if you basically, like, you know, scurry under and over some highways through some, you know, really, you have to trespass. And
yeah, the area sounded pretty sketchy.
It's super sketchy. But then you eventually make it through. There's all these, like, burnt out cars and old containers that are stashed underneath the highway over there, and there's a great big fence around it to keep people out and to keep that stuff in. But I found a spot in the fence.
Wow.
That was pulled open, and so I was able to sneak in. And after you scurry through this bizarre, wild, sort of super overgrown area that's sort of underneath and between on-ramps, you make it to this beautiful little bay. It's so weird. And it's covered with bivalves, and there's so many birds, and it's really gorgeous, but it's also butted up against pretty weird industry. And I'm really fascinated by these kind of forgotten spaces that have been allowed to turn into a really like helpful wilderness that animals can live in. There was a big fat groundhog that lived under there.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Julie, because when I've been following that project as you've been doing it, as you posted it, and you almost get the sense with people try to artificially create a space that like that size to try to create a wild space that size, it wouldn't be as rich. That somehow these organisms find a way to, first of all, get there or be there and then survive and thrive.
I think that's true. And that these spaces that are really allowed to go completely feral there's less, you know, there's less interference from humans. And so animals aren't getting scared off.
That seems to be the key.
Yeah, totally. And so lots of different stuff ends up growing. And as you say, it does become a very rich area that supports a lot more wildlife than, say, a well-maintained public garden would.
Yeah. Didn't you even find larval salamanders in there?
Oh, well, I haven't found them in Queens, but apparently there are larval salamanders to be found
Wow.
in some of the natural springs in Queens. And I have some spots that I'm going back to do some more work this September, and I want to check out some of those spots. I think I'll have missed salamander the salamander time.
Oh yeah. It's over.
But I want to see some of these. There's all these beautiful little natural springs bubbling up
Wow.
in Queens.
That's
New York used to be all water. It was all a swamp. It was
Yeah.
all like a big beaver pond, basically. And so there's a lot of watery wonder there in the city.
I love that. After working in places like this and on the projects that you've worked on, what is your feeling about the natural world and the human world and how it interacts, and what's the best possible way to maintain some kind of biodiversity?
Oh, gosh.
I know that's a big question.
That's a tough question.
Okay, then we can avoid it.
But, well, I do have an answer, though. I mean, on the one hand, going to Chernobyl and seeing the way that wildlife has really thrived there in the absence of humans made me think, oh, people are worse than a nuclear disaster. But then in New York, in some of these wild places, I was thinking, you know, we're really part of it. It's all just one big thing, and we're part of it together. So I have often very conflicting feelings about it.
I also want to mention one set of manipulated photographs called She-Wolves that you do, where you seem to be fascinated by lycanthropy.
Yes, I am. And especially
you're fascinated by women who run with wolves.
Yes, uh-huh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and the idea of lady werewolves in particular.
Yeah, you never see lady werewolves.
No, more so recently, I guess. There's more lady werewolves popping up, but in so many werewolf stories, it's not even possible to be a lady werewolf. They're all dudes. And so it's this kind of, you know, rare beast, the lady werewolf. And I think part of that is because, you know, in society, women aren't really supposed to be big, hairy, aggressive beasts. We're told that that's not ladylike. And I wanted to see what it looked like for me to be a werewolf, yeah, and to explore that forbidden realm of hairy aggressiveness.
And there's other films of yours of Wild Women, for instance, and Captured Yeti, which is that's sort of a neat little film of you just sort of getting out in the wild yourself and sort of connecting to the wild.
Yeah. I've made a number of videos that are sort of love stories about me and wilderness.
Cool.
Me and coyotes. I have a piece that's about a love story between me and a coyote. And these pieces are very they're very performative. They're very much
really
about me exploring nature and having an experience in it and seeing how my body responds to being in it in front of the camera.
Now, we're almost out of time. And you just posted on your Facebook page that you have a new project, and we're probably not going to be able to talk about a lot of it, but it's a post-apocalyptic choose-your-own-adventure, a real large numbers project. What does that mean?
Okay, so
is there a really large numbers thing?
That's my collaboration with New York-based artist Chad Stayrook. We've been working together for about 8 years now, and as a duo, we're called Really Large Numbers. And our newest project is going to be a playable phone app that is in which you're a prepper. It's called SHTF, and am I allowed to say what that
no
stands for? Okay. and so we're making this.
But everybody, just Google it, please, and you'll find out what it is. Okay.
Civilization has fallen. There's a lot of the storyline is about climate change and how the world fell apart because of our bad decisions. And basically, it's a little choose your own adventure game in which you have these post-apocalyptic adventures, and no matter what storyline you follow, you die.
Well, that sounds about what's about to happen. My guest tonight is video artist, performance artist, visual artist, Julia Oldham. Please go to her website. Give out the website again.
It's juliaoldham.com. That's JULIAOLDHAM, like Old Ham.
And check out her films. You'll spend a lot of time there. There's a lot of stuff that you put up, and I really thank you for doing that. Julia, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark. This was great fun.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.